Energy Transition, episode 50. Our topic today is evolution of climate alarmism, part one, because we have part two to come. With Irina Slav, Amy Nimet, David Blackman, and Armando Cavanha. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, that's right. Tell me, please, could you please bring a historical view of the evolution of climate discussion in the recent decades?
Sure. that's a challenging thing to do in a couple minutes. I draw a lot of my information and whatnot from my own research, but also Rupert Darwall, who has done an incredible amount of analysis of the roots of the movement and how it's gone through the policymakers and into our general society. And the way I was thinking of it is like, for the past 50 or 60 years, at the beginning, it was really on the periphery. And there were certain issues that bothered people about the dirty air, about, you know, they wanted clean water, there was things about insecticides and so on. And it was really on an issue by issue basis. And then in the early 70s, you had the, well, in 69, there was the Santa Barbara oil spill, which was really huge. Then Nixon created the EPA. There was the first Earth Day. Then you had the Club of Rome produce its limits to growth. And then you had the energy crisis. And so all of these different issues kind of came together in the early 70s, where people were like, oh, we need to do something. We need to do something. And it reminds me of what's happening now with the Inflation Reduction Act is what I saw in the early 70s, where you had governments just throwing money at trying to find alternative forms of energy in order to defang OPEC and so on and get off oil and all this kind of thing. And then it sort of petered out. And I think the real seminal moment was when you had the creation of the IPCC in the UN, because that created a permanent framework for the different activists and the different scientists and the different policymakers to keep talking about the issue. Before an issue would come up, there would be something and it would fade away. But with the IPCC, it became a permanent fixture. And so then you start to see the growth of grant money, you start to see the growth of different policy groups. And then there's the key thing of philanthropy. So then you had the foundations pumping money in to create lots of different activist organizations, which then seed. So you'll have Greenpeace, and then there'll be key people from Greenpeace who will go and start another organization. And there was this proliferation of environmental groups to keep the pressure going. So after the IPCC was created and you had all this philanthropic money, you just saw this growth and it became a bit of a business. And then the way I think of it also is that it's a network, a movement of movements, of networks. So there's like all of these different groups that come together and they coalesce now and then around different things. And climate change has really become the rationale for revolution. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of people on the left who were looking for some kind of cause to bring down capitalism. And, you know, climate change is a really good one because you could unite the world around some kind of thing that affects everybody and then be able to sort of deconstruct capitalism into some other system. Now, the existing groups today disagree on a lot of certain specifics, but they're all in agreement that our current system has to go. So it's an interesting arrangement of strange bedfellows who are united in the idea that they need to wreck what we've got, but it's unclear what they want to replace it with, because the different groups have different ideas on how they want to replace it, which kind of brings us up to where we are now.
So, David, is more related to ideologies than climate itself.
Yes, as one very wise man who had been an official in both the Carter and Reagan administrations told me in 1995, all the pinks and reds have gone green. And yeah, it's a philosophical movement. It's a, you know, that was basically taken over by a radical left in the 1990s. Prior to that, it had been, as Tammy noted, it had been more of a kind of a loose confederation of these groups with varying ideologies. But then as Al Gore began to become more vocal on it, and you started having the government subsidize all these studies, but only the ones that were going to come to the right predetermined outcome, it became much more organized. And yeah, I mean, there is some disagreement currently on what the final solution needs to be. But a big piece of it, and the Inflation Reduction Act is very much reflective of this, is that you've had three big industries, big business industries, who have become the chosen client industries of the global environmentalist climate alarmist movement, and that is wind power, solar power, and electric vehicles. And these industries, you know, now they exist in large part thanks to these massive subsidies that are coming from the governments of the Western world, the Asian and African and many South American governments are much slower to buy into all of this. It's mainly driven by governments in Europe, Canada, the United States. And it's just become this big feeding frenzy at this enormous trough of hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars in a vast array of subsidies and tax incentives. One bit of news this morning that we saw, Arena, I think, was the first to tweet about it, is that Ford Motor Company is partnering with a Chinese battery maker, CATL, to in their new EV battery factory in Michigan. Now, this is happening a year and a half after Joe Biden pledged to mount a whole of government effort to free supply chains of renewable minerals and batteries and all these other components of renewables and electric vehicles industries from dominance of China. And we see one of the institutions of the American economy for 120 years entering into a joint venture with a Chinese battery company to build a battery factory in Michigan. And so it's just this bizarre progression and all these cottage industries growing into these enormous big businesses are all a product of this climate alarmism, which grows more shrill, you know, with every passing week. And it just has a momentum of its own. There's an inertia moving in that direction, and all these Western governments are flowing with it.
Irina, at the same time, the speech changes to carbon emissions only. It's a perception, I'm not sure about that. Instead of vision of ecosystem as a whole, is it correct or not?
Yes, from what I can remember. As Tammy said, it used to be about oil spills. It used to be about ecosystem destruction, which are all bad things. It used to be about conservation, saving the habitats of this or that species. But really, people cannot think about all this. People cannot get worried enough if they have to think about many different causes. So over the decades, the narrative sort of, you know, it got simplified and it fixated on carbon emissions. Everything is about emissions, and the only party that's guilty of these emissions is the oil industry. It's oil and gas. We have the villain and we have the problem. It's like, I really don't want to be insulting to American culture, but it's like a comic book, the way I see it. It has become like the plot of a comic book. We have one super villain, one big, bad, really, really evil villain. Right. And we have the poor planet and everyone on it in the thrall of this villain. And the good green energy warriors are fighting against the villain to save everyone and the planet. It's no longer about conservation, although, of course, there are groups that do conservation and they are doing, they're making progress. But that's become sort of a secondary concern. We are all focused on emissions. We are all focused about the climate. And the very language of the narrative has changed from being specific and being factual as much as possible. It has now become a talk about apocalypse, about catastrophe, about disaster, and we're all going to die in 10 years or 12 years. And there will be no future because of emissions. It has really become very much oversimplified because people can deal with that. As in, it's easier to absorb, it's easier to worry about, it's easier to blame everything on climate change and big oil. You know, you have the villain, you have the problem. You can work towards solving it by, you know, demonizing the villain and knowing that it's the villain. But you still use the villain's products, you know, because we can't afford not to.
Well,
but
that's
we
a really
continue demonizing and blaming them for everything, for emissions.
Yep.
That's a really good point, because now everyone can be the hero. You know, yes. Oh, I've offset this, right? So now I too am a hero. I'm one of these people who can help stop big oil even while I use the stuff, right? So yeah, excellent point about simplification of the narrative.
But what I find easily digestible. More
for sure. Digestible. And what's interesting is this development in 2008, 2009 with the economic crisis. And the Obama administration really believed this was the time. And there was all this talk about a global Green New Deal. And the UN put out a paper by Edward Barbier. There was lots of conferences about it. John Podesta and the Heinrich Stifting Institute in Germany put together the Great Transformation Conference, where they were talking about how they could weaponize governments to shift the investments and everything to pursue the climate change narrative. And one of the interesting presentations there was Thomas Homer Dixon from Canada, who said, well, this is all well and good, but I'm not sure if we can do this until we have a cultural shift, because the public just isn't on board yet. So we're really going to have to permeate the culture and change the culture. And I think that became the sort of walking, the path that they wanted to do from then, because you had the climate gate that happened, which derailed the Copenhagen talks. And so their global plan kind of fell on, hit the roof, so to speak. And so then there was this movement to change the culture. And then you have the Paris Agreement. By then, if you think about it, there's been, since 2009, 14 years. That's an entire K-12 range of kids,
right,
who have been sold this line, the simplified narrative that, you know, they can do their part if they pressure their parents or whatever. You have the school strikes, you have all this other stuff to save the world. And they, you know, I think that's part of that culture shift. And we've seen it in the media, how the narrative gets amplified across different media networks, like Covering Climate Now or whatever. We see it through everything. It's everywhere. So yeah. I think they were successful in pursuing that cultural shift.
Yeah, and we saw the same thing happen in the wake of Biden's win in the 2020 election with the energy transition. There was a sudden amplification. I mean, people have been talking about an energy transition prior to that, but there was suddenly in December of 2020 a massive, obviously coordinated effort,
yeah,
in the news media, among globalist politicians, and in the entertainment industry, to suddenly start pushing this energy transition narrative. And it was 98% of people don't pay attention to this kind of stuff, really. But it was something I noticed immediately after the election, within a week,
yeah,
the amplification of that narrative suddenly beginning with, you know, now that Biden was going to be installed in January. And, you know, it's only become more amplified ever since. And at every one of these global conferences, you know, it's a major focus of the discussions. And it just, my gosh, when you watched what was happening at the WEF thing in Davos in January and all the discussions around that, it's just so obvious that this is a very highly coordinated effort that, you know, the whole political and entertainment and media establishment are bought into. And it's really difficult for, you know, teachers, school teachers, you know, unfortunately, they get this material forced upon them, and it just doesn't matter, you know, that they really don't want to indoctrinate their kids in their classes. It's part of their own performance evaluation at the end of each school year, and they have to do it. And it's just really pernicious and pervasive in the United States.
No, it's not just there. I mean, all the English-speaking, English-language media that I follow, all of them have special climate reporting sections.
Right.
Climate change news, energy transition news, they have whole sections. And I just started wondering, now that I was listening to you, David, that whether it was because people wanted to read about that and listen, hear about that, or was it being pushed on them? And I think I'm leaning towards the latter, that it wasn't people that want to read about climate change, right, and about the transition, mm-hmm, and about how we're all going to die in 10 years. I think the media is making these decisions.
Yeah, and the social media platforms do it too, and you get
social
shamed
media,
if you don't. Yeah, and if you post against the approved narrative on Facebook, you get suspended and ultimately banned. I mean, I've quit using Facebook entirely at this point because they had me so shadow banned. I've got 5,000 quote friends on Facebook that maybe 20 would see anything I posted there. And it's just a waste of time even trying to use that platform at this point.
Censorship is really serious.
Yeah. Let's talk about Europe's energy security. Would it be possible to fight in two fronts at the same time, zero carbon and adding more oil and gas production capacity? Well, sure. And the companies, the responsible companies, have been moving in that direction for years now. I mean, everyone, I know all of you feel the same way. I'm not against cleaning up the environment. I mean, one of the reasons why this movement had to begin shift its focus to carbon dioxide was because we had done such a great job in the Western world of cleaning up all the real pollution.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, we had rivers in America that used to catch on fire when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s. All of that is gone away. The average automobile, gas-powered automobile, if you poured half a teaspoon of gasoline on the ground, it would emit more carbon in the air than your gas-powered engine, modern gas-powered engine, is going to emit in a year. I mean, that's how well we've dealt with actual real pollution. And so you have to focus on, you know, the boogeyman had to become carbon dioxide. And even that is a fraction of what it used to be from the oil and gas industry. But anyway, y'all, I'm sorry, I kind of got off the point there.
No, you're right. These two fronts are mutually exclusive, by the way, to respond to the comments. So there's some serious cognitive dissonance there in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, like, I get his point about doing both, but both cost a lot of money. And even if the oil and gas industry were to become quote unquote zero carbon, they'd still get nailed with scope 3 emissions. So this is what I'm hearing by the activists in Canada. It's like, why are you spending money offering tax credits for carbon capture and storage when all 80% of the emissions are when it's burned, like when you use the oil or you use the gas or whatever. And so their position is that you shouldn't have those tax credits. We should invest it all into wind and solar, because the burning of the fuels is what creates most of the emissions. That's a bit of a challenge.
And it's all interconnected, because the groups that advocate for that get a lot of money from the wind and solar industries, right? That help support them and their efforts at messaging on behalf of the wind and solar industries. And so it's just this big circular, huge business that's a multi-billion dollar business in America, and I know it is in Europe as well.
Well, this is circular, David. It's kind of a circular economy.
It's a circular economy.
It's not the right circle, but it's good circular.
It's definitely circular.
And it's all subsidized by the government. So, you know, yeah. I mean, it's a hell of a racket, really, when you think about it. Al Gore has become worth over $300 million by latching on to this racket and leveraging it to his own personal benefit. So it's a very lucrative business to be in.
Interesting. Irina, how big is the climate alarmism in Europe and comparing to United States? In my perception, United States has something like a pragmatism to win. It's different from Europe. How is the difference?
Well, I think climate activism has a longer history in Europe. And Europe doesn't have the sort of history in oil and gas production. I mean, there is Norway, of course, there's North Sea. That's pretty much about it for Europe, for local production. Those big oil companies from Europe, most of their operations are in other parts of the world.
Outside, yeah.
But Europe has been, Western Europe especially, has been so wealthy for so long that there are many people with nothing better to do than become activists. I'm sorry if I sound harsh, but this is the way I see it. And especially now, in the last 10 years or so, all these young people who are the product of a really, really excellent environment, materially speaking. They don't have problems. They do not have to worry about their survival the way people their age in African countries have to worry about, or Asian countries, or even in Eastern Europe. Probably there are studies, but if there aren't, someone should do a study about how people feel about climate change in, say, Romania as opposed to France. And yeah. I'm sure the results will be very, very different, because we down here, we have actual problems to do with getting through the month without going into debt. In the United States, I don't have a direct look at how things are in the United States, but I think social media did the job for Americans, especially for young Americans. Because before social media, young people had other things to do, you know. They didn't follow news. I didn't follow news in the 80s when I was growing up.
Right.
And not just because there was no news to follow, but I wasn't interested. I had so many better things to do. But with social media, everyone is on social media, especially young people. And, you know, there's a wonderful exchange of ideas, but there's also a very dangerous exchange of ideas and indoctrination. I think it's dangerous because it leads to those student protests that Greta Thunberg started. Let's not go to school. Let's go and protest that the government is not doing enough about climate change and we will not have a future. Well, if you want to have a future, stay at school, learn your subjects, you know, get an education and do something about it, not protest, you know, do something actual, come up with a better technology to, I don't know, increase fuel efficiency for cars, for example.
I think you make a really good point there, especially now that with the energy transition, it's got into the boardroom. And until it reached the boardroom, there wasn't much hope that this was going to go very far. Politicians could do stuff, but as long as business was still kind of pushing back a little bit and whatnot, then there was less hope that this would become something more permanent. But now that it's been this capture of the corporate world. And there were always some who were sort of thinking in the stakeholder capitalism mindset. And I think with these young people that Irina is talking about, a lot of them have entered into the corporate world. So, you know, I would say over the past 25 years or so, the Ivy League colleges have changed how they teach stuff. And so you get this embedded sense of climate alarm and that we need to do something at these elite universities. And as much as people may not want to hear it, they're the ones who become the corporate leaders. So then you have these corporate leaders who believe that stuff, but also want to make money. And they're sort of facilitating this transition, not partly because they're ideologically committed, but a lot because they're going to make money from it. So there's this tension between the ideologues who think we can make a better world and communism and socialism is better than selfish capitalism. And then you have the people who just want to capitalize on that, you know, to make the money, like Al Gore. Who wouldn't want to have 300 million bucks in the bank to go and jet around
exactly
and do yeah. whatever? So there's that tension there. And as Aretha points out, you know, in other countries in the world, there are bigger problems. And unfortunately, in the G7, the G20, maybe looking for some kind of purpose helps to move this along. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, when you don't have actual problems, you have to make up some problems to have something to worry about and to feel like you're doing something yeah. to solve a problem, because it gives you this feeling of worth. We all want to feel worthy. If there's no other way, we make up problems or let's latch onto the problem somebody else has made up.
Yeah. Sorry. Let's create a problem to try to solve this.
Exactly.
Yes. It's a well-established practice in the pharmaceutical industry, I hear.
So. Exactly. Yes, it is. And I think that, you know, that phenomenon is really more pronounced in the United States than anywhere, because, I mean, our standard of living became so high and children grew up with so much and not having real hardships in life. I mean, there are people in America that do have hardships, but by and large, the average American's life is so much easier than the life of anyone in, you know, some of the developing nations of the world, that you really didn't have real problems to focus on that your parents and grandparents used to have. I'm just, you know, two generations away from people who didn't have running water and electricity in their homes. So even my upbringing was radically different than just two generations before. But when your life is so easy and you see people suffering around the world, you look for something to latch onto to give your life more meaning and to be able to signal your virtue about doing something to solve a perceived problem. And so, you know, that's how you end up with display cases full of fake meat in the superstore, you know, the supermarket, right? That, by the way, in my local supermarket a year ago, the fake meat part of it literally filled up about a third of the entire meat section. And now it's down to about maybe a 30th of it, because nobody's buying the stuff. It sits Great. On the shelf and gets moldy. And so people latched on to that for a little bit and then realized it tasted bad. And, oh, I need to find something else, so maybe I'll find another way to reduce my carbon footprint. But the point being that everyone's in search of meaning for their lives and something to say, I'm a good person for doing. And unfortunately, for children growing up in America in this century, it has been the best way to signal your virtue is to be able to say you're doing something to reduce your carbon footprint. And so that's what so many have focused on. And as y'all said, they're coming into the corporate C-suites now and getting onto corporate boards. And so it ends up becoming news when BP, one of the world's largest oil companies for over a century, you know, makes an announcement that it's actually going to refocus some of its capital on its core business. That's a news item now that BP's, you know, going back to being an oil company to some extent.
Yeah, so that's right.
That's how
yeah.
we get there.
Yeah. Ronald is coming with a question.
climate alarmism will continue to evolve, just like David Suzuki switched from his 1970s stance that the ice age was coming to the planet is on fire. The pendulum will shift back and forth to the dangers of cooling as the natural cycles bring back the cold. Yeah, I think that's I'm sure that's right. And, you know, there was a report just last week that we haven't really had any real warming globally in, 7 years now, despite dramatic increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so, yeah, I mean, it goes in cycles. It always has and it always will.
That's why climate change is so great. It's not warming. It's not right. Cooling. That's why winters have become extreme weather and summers have become extreme weather. You can call anything extreme weather and blame it on climate change, which was brought about by big oil. But climate change was a genius.
Right. It's why cold fronts have names now, right?
So this goes back to what Irina said about the simplification of the message. And what I heard from listening and reading Steve Koonin's book and Richard Lindzen's work, Judith Curry's work, is that
Steve Koonin's book right here.
Yeah, it's so awesome. And they were talking about how the scientist who wanted to say, well, you know, maybe CO2 emissions aren't the big boogeyman you think they are, were completely cut out of academia. They're pushed out or their voices were minimized and so on. So you can't even have a conversation about what is the perceived problem. Yeah. And so you're not allowed to deviate from that at all. I'm sure there's going to be a warning on YouTube about this, about our conversation. But you can't even raise that issue, which then, like Judith Curry was talking about, we have weather amnesia. We can't even remember what happened in the weather 2 years ago, let alone 50 years ago. So when things they call extreme, because we can't remember there was a really bad blizzard in 75. So there's this immediacy of everything that we do. It's like everything is in the now. And we can't, she talks about weather amnesia. We have amnesia about everything that didn't happen yesterday.
Right. Yeah, I've got a great anecdote about that. When Winter Storm Uri, this cold front with a name, came through Texas a couple of years ago, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, a young reporter who wrote a great story, actually, so I'm not bashing him at all, but he calls me. He had seen a Forbes piece I had written the morning that my power went out. And, you know, and during the course of our conversation, you know, I started talking about the fact, well, you know, gosh, we had a very similar event to this in 2011, and the legislature didn't do anything to fix the system. And he said, wait, we had an event like this just 10 years ago? And I said, yeah. And we had one in 1993 and another in 87, another in 84. And he said, but everybody's saying this is unprecedented. And I said, no, this is not unprecedented. It's just that people forget. And I'm old and I have a long memory for these things. And I said, go, you know, I'll even do some, I even volunteered to do a little research for him. I went back and found news reports about all that stuff. But the point being, you're right. I mean, people have weather amnesia. And so when the weather people become climate alarmists, nobody, you know, the normal viewer doesn't have any memory of anything different. You don't have that context.
No, and even if they do, they are encouraged to forget about it by, you know, saying this is unprecedented, this is catastrophic, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
that's right. SRB.
SRB, welcome, SRB. What do you think of G. Maloney's desire to make Italy into an energy hub between North Africa and Europe? Is such an initiative even feasible, considering the climate alarmism posture in Europe? Well, I will let our Europeans on the panel answer that question.
Very good question. Yeah. Once again, we come to the question of how do you square between your net zero ambitions and your need, immediate and very urgent need, for fossil fuels right now, because you're nowhere near net zero. It could be feasible if this could be squared, and I think the current Italian prime minister is more pragmatic about energy, but I may be wrong because I do not follow Italian politics closely, but she looks like she wants her country to be energy secure. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because there's so many shifting dynamics there with the European politics, because the Europe is notorious for taking an eternity to make a decision about anything. You know, I think of all the different pipelines that we're going to come across, you know, Nabucco and all those other ones from Eastern Europe through into the Western Europe. Syria was planning to be the hub for getting oil and gas into Western Europe. Well, that fell apart. So I don't know. France was planning to do something, but they got so much pushback. They don't want to connect the pipelines from Spain, you know, from North Africa through Spain into France. Will Italy be better positioned? Maybe. But as I said, these things take forever. And there's so much political wrangling and whatnot that goes into it. And the fact that, you know, the European Parliament is half of it or three quarters of it is pushing so hard for the Green Deal. I don't know.
Yeah, they're not completely independent EU members. So there will be pushback for sure.
And wouldn't Italy, as a member of the EU, face some sort of sanctions if they don't
tell the party line? I don't know about sanctions, but they will be criticized.
Just criticism, okay.
Well, could be other leverage employed as well, the way they do in Poland, right? Yeah. So they hold back payments or stuff like that, to influence.
Like our federal government does here in the States.
Yeah.
Irina, is there a connection between climate alarmism and the totalitarian order, something related?
Well, yes, there is. Do we have time for this?
Next time?
Well, that could be part two.
Part two?
Yeah, maybe leave it for next time, because I really feel that this core alarmist movement has effectively become a tool for changing the order and changing it into a way that is quite familiar to me from my childhood and will be even more familiar to people who are older than myself. But I do suggest we leave this particular topic for part two, so I can really give it a go.
Great. Okay, almost 40 minutes, I suppose.
Can I add one thing?
Sure, of course.
I wanted to mention education, because so Poland and certain areas in Canada and the United States, the TVA, have agreed to employ a GE Mitsubishi small modular reactor. And Poland has said they want to build 79 of them. So they went and signed an agreement with a bunch of universities in Poland a couple of weeks ago, saying, we need you to expedite the education of the appropriate employees we're going to need to run these things. And so I think that's really fascinating, because in Calgary, which is the center of the energy industry in Canada, last year they decided to discontinue their petroleum engineering because there wasn't apparently not enough student interest. Yeah. And so what happens?
Why.
Right. So what happens to an industry that no longer trains enough engineers to do it, to run it? And so are we going to be importing Russians? Oh, no, we can't do that. Are we going to be importing Chinese petroleum engineers or other Eastern European petroleum engineers, because we're not training them? And then what happens with all these SMRs that they want to put up all over the place? Are they training enough people? Poland sees that threat, and they're committing to train people. But I'm not so sure what's going on in Canada or the United States. So the UK has also signed on to do the same SMR. It's the one by GE Mitsubishi.
Interesting. Is where in Poland you mentioned?
Yeah, it's Poland. So Poland is committed to building 79 of them.
And of course, you need people to service them, if not build them.
Right.
So need the right kind of people with the right education.
Yeah. And that's great, because the reality is, if you're actually going to ever get to a zero carbon electrical system, nuclear is going to have to be the path forward.
Absolutely.
Wind and solar cannot do this.
No.
And right now what we have going on is just this massive grift. It's a racket for these subsidies. And in about 10 years, we're going to have some kind of an enormous energy crisis, because we haven't invested enough in new petroleum reserves. And that's when I think once we have a big crisis, then governments will realize, look, we have to get serious again about nuclear, because that's the only zero emission path forward that's viable.
So they want to really screw up and then fix things instead of avoiding the screw up and fixing things.
The construction of nuclear plants takes a long time to.
A long time.
So that's
unless they're expedited by the government, of course. One of the reasons they take such a long time is because the government delays and refuses to issue permits. And
there's no time enough.
Right.
Well, I don't know about these SMRs, if because they're done in this modular design, if they produce it like on a factory basis, maybe the assembly is quicker. But even so, I don't know. I don't know.
So let's wait for the part two of this same topic. Will be great.
It's a big
thank
topic.
You. Yeah, it was a pleasure to meet you today again.
Always. Yeah, let's see if we get deplatformed from YouTube for this one.
That's good. You can see people the contacts of David, Irina, Temet, and myself. A great day for you all.
Have a great
same
day.
To you.
A great
thank
week.
You.
Hope we all have a wonderful week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.